Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review, dated Thursday, January 12, 2017. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Getting the Lead Out, Law Would Require Schools to Test Water, by Teresa Churchill and Tony Reed, H&R staff writers. Decatur. Anna Water's Head Start would be in line for a double whammy under a new rule that would require older Illinois elementary schools and daycare centers to test their drinking water for lead and notify parents of the results. The Effie Oliver Center, built in 1942, would have to be tested by December 31st to the tune of $500 to $1,000. Then the same would have to happen at the New Horizons Center, completed in 1994 by the end of 2018. We certainly want to provide a safe environment, said Gail Evans, executive director of Decatur-Macon County Opportunities Corporation, the community action agency that runs the preschool program. It could impact our delivery of the service, but you have to try to work it out with the resources you have available. One saving grace for the program, designed to prepare 378 disadvantaged children for kindergarten, is that the Decatur Housing Authority owns the Effie Oliver Child and Family Center at 1075 North Morgan Street and would have to foot that part of the bill. Area superintendents, while acknowledging that validating the safety of their drinking water could only be a good thing, say leaving schools to find a way to pay the cost leaves a bitter taste in the mouth. PANA's David Lett said if the state would just pay schools the funding they are owed, in his district's case about $350,000, such concerns would be diluted greatly. No one is excited about unfunded mandates, but the reality is if we could just kind of get our house in order in Illinois and get a budget passed and start paying the existing bills, I'd be ecstatic, he said. Senate Bill 550, which passed 108-1 in the House Monday, also has Governor Bruce Rauner's support, according to a spokesperson in his office. The proposal follows the lead-tainted water crisis in Flint, Michigan, which shed light on the dangers of lead contamination. Children are most at risk to the effects of elevated lead levels, which can cause developmental delays. Testing drinking water in all Illinois schools and daycares is an inexpensive way to immediately identify and stop lead exposure in young children that would otherwise cost families, schools, and government much more, Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan said in a statement. Since last year, her office has called for mandated lead testing in schools with the Illinois Environmental Council, which says there is a lack of information available to parents about water supplies. One of the sticking points was cost. Earlier versions called for water suppliers to pick up the tab, and they objected. Unveiled as lawmakers gathered for the final days of the current legislative session, the proposal applies to all public and private schools with students up to grade 5 and facilities built before 2000. Schools built before 1987 would have to test by the end of the year. Those constructed between 1987 and 2000 would have until the end of 2018. Lead pipes were banned nationwide in 1986. There are about 2,500 elementary schools in Illinois, and according to the IEC, many have already been tested for lead. This includes more than 300 schools in Chicago that were tested last year, and all Decatur public schools tested in the early 1990s, including 17 buildings serving younger students. Jim Gortner, director of Buildings and Grounds, said his predecessor, Mike Soderoff, hired the work done, and that water sources identified as having unacceptable levels of lead were repaired in a timely fashion. We are confident that the district's drinking water is safe and exceeds the Environmental Protection Agency's minimum requirements, Gortner said. Illinois also has about 11,000 licensed daycare centers and homes that would be affected. This is going to be more of a burden for some than others, said Zach Messersmith with the Illinois Association of School Boards. He gave possible examples of post-testing changes, such as having to replace pipes or drinking fountains. The bill does not mandate those fixes. Deanne Heck, superintendent of Central A&M, covering Assumption and Moquegua, said she is waiting for the state to make good on $740,000 currently owed her school district. She predicted superintendents will swap notes on the best firms charging reasonable prices to do the new lead testing, which she supports. Heck also has some other ideas on how the state might allow schools to pay for the testing. They could let us use money from Life Safety Fund, she said. Normally, life safety pays for things that pertain to the safety of the children within buildings, so we'll see. Kristen Kendrick Weichel, superintendent at Warrensburg Latham, said her district's elementary building was built in 1970 and would have to test for lead this year. The idea is an admirable one, she said. The part that is most concerning to me is this is another unfunded mandate that is being placed upon schools. Many of the ideas behind mandates have good intentions, but they can quickly add up, diverting money away from supplies, materials, and staff. Shauna Aja, executive director of Baby Talk, said something similar about her agency's Early Head Start program, serving children birth to three, in a building constructed in 1972. We need to put children's safety first, but we also need to manage the financial burden, Aja said. Many of us are already out here providing services without payment. Jim Alpe, executive director of the Decatur Housing Authority, said the pipes in the Effie Oliver Center, a former Longview Place apartment building converted to a preschool in the early 1970s, are copper, joined with a bit of solder that may or may not contain lead. We absolutely will have the water tested, but I am confident we won't find a public health problem there, he said. Local police say Ferguson effect doesn't deter from work. By Justin Kahn, H&R staff writer, Lisa Marie Payne, Associated Press writer, Decatur. Decatur Police Chief Jim Goetz said while Decatur officers aren't policing less because of the high-profile uses of force against black citizens and the backlash they've caused, he did say training on how to deal with the volatile situations is always evolving. It's been called the Ferguson effect, officers backing off of policing out of fear that their actions will be questioned after the fact. A recent Pew Research Center national survey reported that 3/4 of officers asked say they're hesitant to use force, even when appropriate, and are less willing to stop and question suspicious people. Goetz and Macon County Sheriff's Lieutenant John Butts said they'd heard of the Ferguson effect, but said they didn't feel their officers were tentative or any less vigilant because of possible repercussions. None of my officers have indicated to me they're hesitant in making decisions in use of force in situations like that, Goetz said. Butts said he'd first heard of the Ferguson effect at the FBI National Academy in Quantico, a program of the FBI Academy for Active U.S. Law Enforcement Personnel. He said he didn't see it among his officers. It's something everyone is aware of, but in our office we have a job to do, and our officers are staying diligent, Butt said. Our officers carry a badge and a gun for a living, but they practice great discretion and do things within the accordance of the state. We live, work, and police in the community. we treat people with dignity and respect. In 2014, a white officer in Ferguson, Missouri, shot and killed black teenager Michael Brown, setting off a movement drawing greater scrutiny of police use of force against black citizens. In the years since, often fatal encounters with police in such cities as Baltimore, Baton Rouge, Milwaukee, Chicago, and New York have put officers under the microscope, especially as video has captured more of these events. In 2016, police officer Andrew Whitmer shot black man Lonnie D. Mitchell, but was cleared of any wrongdoing by the Macon County State's Attorney's Office. Mitchell was armed with a knife strapped to his wrist and a BB gun that looked like a semi-automatic handgun. Mitchell survived. There has been a concern nationally, largely shared in anecdotes, of officers holding back on stopping suspicious people or other policing out of concern that they'd be cast as racist. The Pew survey provides the first national evidence that those concerns may be having a real impact on how officers do their jobs. Officers are concerned about being the next viral video, and so that influences what they do and how they do it and how they think about it, said Daryl Stevens, executive director of the Major Cities Chiefs Association. He added that he doesn't believe it's rampant or that officers are turning a blind eye. But I still have to believe it may be in a marginal call situation where there's a reasonable suspicion on the bubble that those are the ones they pass up. Getz said while he doesn't believe his officers are backing off out of fear of repercussions, he said their training is constantly updated. Training will always adapt to the times, Getz said. Force has always been used in my 18 years with the department, but there's a lot more decision-making that goes into use of force. That decision-making is always being adapted and added to. Getz said use of force is always a last resort. An officer's presence and communication are always the first tools. Before any force is used, we're always going to try what we call verbal judo first, Getz said. It would be great if our presence and communication would get everyone to comply. But that's not how it happens in the real world. Officers often have to decide in a matter of seconds whether to go hands-on, use the taser, or use a lethal weapon. Butts said Macon County Sheriff's deputies attend regular training through the Law Enforcement Training Advisory Committee in Springfield and have regular discussions about how to handle volatile situations. Policing in the 21st century is different from what it was in the past, and the training reflects that, Butts said. We pride ourselves on being well-trained. We want officers to be aware at all times. Nothing is routine, and they should handle each call objectively and professionally. The nonpartisan Pew Research Center questioned at least 8,000 officers from departments with at least 100 officers between May 19th and August 14th last year, most of it ahead of the fatal shootings of 5 officers in Dallas and 3 officers in Baton Rouge. Some of the key findings: 86% of officers said that fatal encounters between blacks and police have made policing more difficult. 93% said they're more concerned about safety. 76% said they're more reluctant to use force when appropriate. 75% said interactions between police and blacks have become more tense. 72% said they or their colleagues are more reluctant to stop and question people who seem suspicious. The survey also showed a stark difference in how white and black officers view the protests that have taken place after some of the high-profile shootings of black suspects in the past several years, with black officers believing the protests are genuine acts of civil disobedience designed to hold police accountable, while white officers are more skeptical of the protesters' motives. White officers and black officers have very different views about where we are as a country in terms of achieving equal rights, said Kim Parker, the Director of Social Trends Research for the Pew Research Center. The survey also suggested a divide between police and the communities they serve on some social issues of the day. For example, 2/3 of all officers say deadly encounters with blacks are isolated incidents, but 60% of the general public said they believe they are signs of a broader problem between police and blacks. Count Butts as one of those who sees the encounters as isolated incidents. "There are a lot of good police officers in this country," Butts said. "You hear about 2 or 3 a year who have a negative impact. But the rest of those 900,000 police officers go out and do an awesome job day in and day out in some pretty tough circumstances." 100th General Assembly Steals Itself for Budget by Dan Petrella, H&R Springfield Bureau Chief. Springfield. A banner hanging above the stage at Sangamon Auditorium at the University of Illinois at Springfield on Wednesday during the Illinois House inauguration ceremony offered advice to members of the 100th General Assembly. Quoting President John F. Kennedy, it read, "Let us not seek to fix blame for the past. Let us accept our own responsibility for the future." After the 99th General Assembly failed to enact a comprehensive state budget during its 2-year term, there's plenty of blame to go around. Members of both political parties and both legislative chambers acknowledge that an end to the budget standoff is long overdue. It remains unclear, however, how the Democratic-controlled legislature will find enough common ground to approve a budget that will also satisfy Republican Governor Bruce Rauner's call for changes to the state's business and political climate. Despite a new crop of state representatives and senators taking the oath of office for the first time Wednesday in separate ceremonies, the lay of the land in Springfield is relatively unchanged. On the Democratic side, long-serving House Speaker Michael Madigan and Senate President John Cullerton, both of Chicago, were easily reelected to their positions, as were House Minority Leader Jim Durkin, Republican of Western Springs, and Senate Minority Leader Christine Redonio, Republican of Lamont. Despite a months-long campaign by the Illinois Republican Party to pressure Democrats to vote against Madigan, none did. The lone holdout among the 67 House Democrats was State Representative Scott Drury of Highwood, who voted present. In accepting a 17th term in the position he has held for all but 2 of the past 33 years, Madigan laid out an agenda that he said would boost economic growth in the state without competing in a race to the bottom on issues like workers' compensation and collective bargaining, a shot at Rauner's policy agenda. Madigan called for increased investment in higher education, which has been hit hard by the budget turmoil of the past 2 years, along with transportation and communication infrastructure. The speaker also called for cutting the state's corporate income tax rate in half, while also ensuring that all businesses pay something. And in an op-ed Wednesday in the Springfield State Journal Register, Madigan also promoted a tax surcharge on income of more than $1 million to fund education, and an increase in the state's minimum wage. "I believe we can grow the economy and create jobs without hurting middle-class families," Madigan said. For his part, Durkin said Republicans would work with Democrats on their policy agenda if it includes things like paying down the state's $11 billion backlog of bills, reforming the severely underfunded public pension systems, reducing unemployment, and enacting truly balanced budgets. "If that is your intention, then we will work with you every step of the way," Durkin said. He said Republicans are desperately seeking to be part of the solution and encourage bipartisan cooperation. That kind of bipartisan cooperation has been on display of late in the Senate, which held its inauguration simultaneously at the Capitol. Rauner presided until Cullerton retook the role of president. After the oaths were taken and Cullerton and Redonio were re-elected, the Senate kicked off its new term by unanimously approving a change to the chamber's rules that going forward will limit the Senate president and minority leader to 5 2-year terms in those leadership roles. The move was a down payment on an ambitious budget compromise worked out between Cullerton and Redonio, which includes tax increases, 6 new casino licenses, reforms to the state pension systems, and workers' compensation laws, and a host of other initiatives. We have made it clear that the Senate will offer solutions and leadership, Cullerton said, in accepting a fifth term as Senate president. We are filing more than a dozen proposals. The intent is to quickly pass them in this new session. Cullerton said he and Redonio made a promise during the 2009 inauguration to work together and have made good on that promise. Redonio said it's going to take lawmakers on both sides of the aisle for the Senate to pass a compromise that includes the new revenue and structural reforms need to address the state's problems. It is my hope today that this is not just the beginning of a new General Assembly, Redonio said. My hope is that this is a new day for a better Illinois. State Senator Dan Brady, Republican of Bloomington, who formally nominated Durkin as the GOP candidate for House Speaker, said he's cautiously optimistic that the impasse can be brought to an end. But, he said, it will take continued pressure from rank-and-file lawmakers on leadership. There has to be that communication there between Madigan and Durkin that presently is going on in the Senate between President Cullerton and Leader Redonio, Brady said. That has to extend over to the House. Jim Durkin has extended his hand to do that. I hope the Speaker will accommodate. State Senator Andy Menar, Democrat of Bunker Hill, said he's glad to see a new session of the General Assembly begin with substantive discussions about policies to grow the state's economy and balance the budget. That's a positive step forward that is necessary to break the current impasse, Menar said. I hope all of these things lead to a balanced and permanent state budget. MacArthur High School renovations reveal masonry problems by Valerie Wells, H&R staff writer. Decatur. Change orders in construction projects are not uncommon, and in projects the size of the high school renovations in Decatur over the past few years are to be expected. At Tuesday's school board meeting, Jim Gortner, director of buildings and grounds, told the board about the second of 3 anticipated change orders regarding the masonry at MacArthur High School. The first, in October, cost about $35,000 to replace a limestone facade above the east entrance. When the contractor was working on the existing limestone facade above the entrance, the contractor found out the fasteners holding the huge limestone were corroded. There was nothing holding these things up, Gortner said. This was a safety issue, so they were instructed to remove the limestone, and they had to construct protective scaffolding so the kids could still use the entrance. The second change order was related to the first, because when contractors from Otto Baum Company were replacing the limestone, they discovered steel lintels that had rusted, and some of the bricks were damaged. That, with the rent for the scaffolding and design of the new facade, came to more than $28,000. The third change order, which hasn't come in yet, but Gortner anticipates shortly, is due to the replacement of bricks that have deteriorated. In removing and replacing those, other bricks were found that were also damaged. He doesn't yet know the total number of bricks or final cost, but expects the total additional cost for masonry work with all 3 changes will be about $100,000. The district is still ahead financially, Gortner said. The original contract was $536,000, and with the 2 change orders, that brings it to about $600,000, he said. I'm ballparking the third change order at $50,000, hopefully less. So I'm still very pleased with the total project cost to repair. Ciro Gordo Schools to seek tax increase for improvements by Teresa Churchill, H&R senior writer. Ciro Gordo. Voters will be asked to approve a 49-cent property tax increase to pay for an addition and other improvements to the Ciro Gordo Junior Senior High School. During a special meeting Wednesday evening, the school board voted 6-0 to place a referendum on the April 4th ballot, allowing the sale of $8 million in bonds towards the cost of connecting the two parts of the school with 18,500 square feet of new space. The addition would encompass a central entrance, provide a new home for the school library, and house a new gym for the junior high, while an old one dating back to 1929 would be turned into a multipurpose auditorium. The tax increase of 49 cents per $100 in equalized assessed valuation would amount to an extra $134 annually on a $100,000 home. The school board's vote was preceded by no discussion and no public comment, virtually all of the hour-long meeting taken up by a review of the process that led up to this point. Sales tax increase for sheriff's office likely on April ballot by Ryan Voiles, H&R staff writer, Decatur. Another effort to help fund the Macon County Sheriff's Office will likely head back to voters this spring. The county board is expected to approve a resolution at tonight's meeting that would allow voters to decide on the April ballot on whether to implement a quarter-cent sales tax to increase to help the sheriff's office retain deputies. This money would go to the sheriff's department and help them out with their financial situation, said County Board Chairman Jay Dunn. If approved, the increase would bring in about $2.5 million per year to pay for the operations of the sheriff's office and the county jail. The language of the resolution is nearly identical to that which was placed on the November ballot, as the plan would still cost customers an additional 25 cents for each $100 spent. That plan was handily voted down, 64% to 36%. Since it was voted down, the sheriff's office was able to avoid layoffs by transferring four officers to the patrol division and eliminating their specialty positions. Those non-grant positions, referred to by Sheriff Thomas Schneider as proactive policing, included the school resource officer, drug interdiction detective, narcotic detective, and a deputy U.S. Marshal. Six positions have also remained unfilled in the department. Like other county departments, the sheriff's office was asked to make cuts of 7% for its current budget, equaling to about $660,000. And with personnel about 85% of the budget, Schneider said, at the time that there were not many other places to go other than elimination of staff. If the resolution is approved, Dunn said, efforts would be made to better clarify exactly where the money would be used, in this case, just to the sheriff's office. The county board meets at 6 p.m., room 514, in the Macon County Office Building, 141 South Main Street. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Thursday, January 12, 2017. Please stay tuned.